Marjorie is going to stay with us here. We are joined here in studio. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is with us, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC. Always a pleasure to have her in the studio. Kimberly, good to see you.
Thank you.
Can we have to put Kimberly's mic up so the world can hear her? And Linda McAllister is on the phone, a political commentator, author of Spoken Thoughts of an Amalgamated Advocate in Today's America. And Lenny, it's been a while. Welcome back to the show. Do you have Lenny there? Pot it up.
I'm here. Thanks for having me. Hey, I appreciate it.
How are you, Lenny? Good to hear your voice again. You're in D.C. now, no longer North Carolina, I understand. Is that correct?
I am in D.C., yes.
Everybody's got to go to D.C.
Couldn't stay away. Okay.
So, for you folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. We'll come to these calls. I wonder, we've been talking about this Sandy, and there have been a lot of people who have talked about how Sandy may be affecting this election from Governor Christie, who many Republicans are screaming at because he was having this incredible time with President Barack Obama in his helicopter and just lauding Obama for what he did to respond to the disaster. People are just kind of blowback, I guess, with Romney's, the governor's FEMA comments that he made have come back to be part of the news again. And people just think about what the role of government is. I think that there may be, and then some people say it could be a Sandy effect with people not being able to get to the polls. But Kimberly, let me start with you. It's good to see you, and the Sandy effect.
I think there has been a lot of talk about. I had even heard briefly some report that talked about extending voting for a day in the affected areas, which I think raises a number of questions and concerns about the vitality of our process, election process. I mean, at this point, I'm starting to feel remnants of us functioning similar to developing nations in terms of how elections are run, and oftentimes the U.S. feels compelled to step in and orchestrate a process, and in many ways it feels the same way right now in America.
Lenny?
Well, I think that when you look at Sandy and you look at the aftermath of that, I think that the overreaction, and I do think it's an overreaction to the Christie-Obama type of scenario that went down last week. I think that when we look back at this, I think one thing that this highlights, this whole scenario about Republicans being mad at Chris Christie giving too much credit to the president, is the fact that Republicans should have been able to run away with this election weeks ago. The economy hasn't really gotten any better. If this election was all about the economy and Governor Romney won the first debate, which was based on domestic policy, then you couple the Benghazi situation, which was supposed to tarnish President Obama's foreign policy accomplishments, why isn't Governor Romney pulled away as much as he should have? And that goes back to the second and third debate. That goes back to the ground game. That goes back to some of the messaging. That goes back to some of the ads. And it may even go back to the candidacy itself. So I think that Republicans trying to pin this on Chris Christie and saying, okay, this was the October surprise we couldn't count on, and with Sandy coming through, Governor Christie, why did you give President Obama as much praise? I just think it's quite hollow, to be quite honest. I think that Chris Christie was right on board and said what he should have said. And honestly, that level of honesty isn't going to play very well in 2012, but I wouldn't be surprised if it played well for him in 2016.
Imara.
I mean, I think that there is a definite Sandy effect. I mean, one of the things that one considers is whether or not you fire the guy in office. And if you are thinking about doing that, there are a lot of things of whether or not the person coming in can be up to the job and all the rest of it. Well, suddenly a national crisis comes along, and the president suddenly is the president again. And you see exactly how he, in this instance, maybe future will change that, but how he is able to navigate that and to reinforce some of the essential elements of being the president. And I think that it just sort of turned the tide, because there are existing doubts about Mitt Romney, and if you were willing to be able to give him a chance, that would be about a certain doubt of President Obama's ability to be able to do the job. And I think that a lot of that doubt just got, ironically, washed away by Sandy and the images. It was 4 days of him being president, a couple of days of Mitt Romney off the trail, and then when he was on the trail creating controversy and sowing doubt in the very states that he needed to carry. And so I think there's been a Sandy effect, and I think it's benefited President Obama.
Well, I would agree with, I think, what everyone said. I was amazed, Mark, and our guest, about how an opportunity arose. And of course, I'm a tad bit partisan. I am always trying to be very clear about where I lie socially on a whole host of issues. But I was very surprised, given the opportunity to kind of dismiss very quickly and engage this conversation around Sandy very quickly, that the Romney campaign chose to be silent. And what they had were surrogates really attacking the governor of New Jersey for being too accommodating to the president of the United States. And I believe if Mitt Romney, if Governor Romney had been very firm, forceful, and authoritative on his position on FEMA, very quickly, instead of ignoring the press, over the course of the day, he was asked 14 times to make a statement, and he just smiled and looked at the reporters or ignored the reporters. And it really, I believe, it became problematic for his campaign after that day long of silence mm-hmm. on how they could then step in and, I think, call the press out on trying to create a story around Chris Christie and a story around Sandy, where Mitt Romney could have, and I think rightfully so, been very presidential in saying, I support the president's actions. I believe that the president is doing the right thing right now as our nation goes through this difficulty. And it was amazing to me that they chose a different task. Now, the other thing that, on the flip side, the polls are very close. Regardless of how presidential Barack Obama looked during Sandy and a whole lot of other, it's clear to me that the momentum is now on the president's side. And Sandy may have helped slow Mitt Romney. But almost all the national polls show that this election is very close, even in a lot of the battleground states where the president was doing extraordinarily
well.
But
did we not see the same thing in 08, though, in terms of down to the wire, it appeared that there was still this neck-and-neck race possibly existing between the two candidates. So I'm not sure if I buy into the way it's been positioned for us in the media. And, in fact, I see it very much as the media's role to make sure we are engaged in this way and to believe that there is something to tune into so that we will either turn into their station or make sure we show up at the polls on tomorrow. So I'm not sure if it is as neck-and-neck is what we are positioning it to be, but I think it's good business for it to be neck and neck.
Well, that's what I was rather to guess here as well. I mean, I guess I read these polls every day, and I'm not somebody who just likes to talk about the election in terms of polls because it's the issues I think most of the media are not tackling, which mm-hmm. just drives me crazy. No one talking about climate change, nobody talking about poverty, nobody talking about some of the real issues, just kind of party lines being thrown out on either side, which just is infuriating, which we'll come to in a minute. But when it does come to polls, as I conclude this part, one person I follow a lot is Nate Silver and the New York Times, because he does what other people don't do, which he's a mathematician, and he puts together an aggregate and studies all the polls in America, who they polled, how they polled them, what kind of questions they asked, and then comes out with how he analyzes all those polls and together. And he puts it as a very close race, consistently at like 50-point-some percent for Barack Obama, with a very narrow lead, but kind of blowing him away
in the electoral college.
In what I consider the outdated electoral college.
Absolutely.
That's
the issue we should be taking up.
The electoral college?
Absolutely.
Let's take a poll here. Speaking of, but then we'll open the phones. I mean, so starting with Lenny. Lenny, I'd like to know, because you've had said some things recently that I'm sure when you go to your next Republican gathering, they could be throwing things at you. But
that's been like that for a while.
The Electoral College, I mean, it seems to me in some ways this is a 19th century mechanism that is just out of date. Maybe outlived its usefulness.
I don't know. I think that as we look at the censuses every 10 years and how the congressional districts change, and how some districts fade away, places such as Illinois, and some districts are added to states such as Texas and your Floridas. I think that when you have these modifications with the Electoral College, it works. You can't have a whole bunch of people in New York City telling people in Iowa what to do. And if you go to a popular vote, one, Republicans will never win an election. Because if you look at the population, it's going to the urban environments. And so you would have 12 million people in New York City dictating to states that may only have 12 million people in it in general. And I don't know if that's fair. I think that you want a president that is going to go around the country and should be able to communicate a diverse message that makes sense, that's not cobblestoning a bunch of lies here and there just to please certain constituencies, which we already have a problem with. It would get worse. If you think that they're only speaking to a certain group of people now, it would be that much worse. If I were a Democrat, I would go speak to California, I'd speak to Texas, I'd speak to Florida, I'd speak to New York. I'd try to get the money and the votes there, and I would go tell Republicans you can have flyover country, because flyover country can't beat me in the top seven cities of the United States. Now, the problem with that is you would have a power shift politically that may allow, you know, the United States and the way federal governments run to look a lot like how our cities are run. How does that look? How does New York look? How does Detroit look? How does Chicago look?
New York looks pretty good compared to some other cities.
New York actually looks great. I mean, yeah. One of the things that Mike Bloomberg said was he, you know, looked boldly into the camera on Tuesday and he goes, yeah, everyone asks why we pay high taxes, but we have something to show for it. So I don't think that New York is the best example.
Poverty in those cities too. Now let's be fair. Let's look at Detroit. Let's look at New York City. And you talked previously about the economic disparities. And
I guarantee you talk to black residents
in Chicago. You talk to black residents in New York, where I was in Chicago for 2 years for my radio show. You talk to black residents in New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Detroit, all the way out to Los Angeles. They're going to tell you a completely different story than what Mayor Bloomberg and other mayors will tell you about their fair cities.
And before we have to go to break, and Amara, I know you have to roll. Let me let you get your word in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, two things. One about cities. There's a piece in the Times Empire in between about the spaces in between New York and Washington and how poor they are. It's about overall trends in the economy, not what's going on in the cities nor the management of them. But more broadly, I think that this Electoral College one is about big states versus small states. And if we want to have a country where the large states and the large populations dominate, I like that, then that would be fine. if we want to increase a further marginalization of rural America, then we do away with the Electoral College. It's about which imperfect system we want, not whether or not the system is imperfect.
And I know we're going to break here in about 2 minutes, but Kimberly, let me let you jump in real fast.
I would concur. I think it is an outdated, antiquated system that now needs to be done away with so that the voice of the people actually elects who its leader will be. That, in my eyes, is what is a democratic nation, not the idea that we creatively construct a process to create some sense of balance or equity across a system, which, again, doesn't work in 21st century, but certainly did work in the 19th century.
And now...
Can I ask, if that's the case, then should we give Florida four senators and give Iowa only one senator?
No, I'm one of those who might even want to do away with the entire U.S. Senate. But,
oh, my Lord!
But I... But I think that we could argue that either way. But even now, with the Electoral College, what that's done is I'm looking at the map, you know, and so what it does is forces the election to not talk to New York, to not talk to California, to not even talk to Montana. So all you talk to is where you think the votes are be close. So they're in Ohio, they are in Iowa, they are in Florida, they are a little bit in Virginia. So the election is being focused in on some larger populous states, but some smaller ones, and that where the electoral votes are going to be. I mean, so that skews it as well. I mean, if there was no electoral college, or they divided up the electoral college or something, then it might force a presidential candidate to campaign everywhere, you know, as opposed to just campaigning in a few narrowly defined purple states, as we call them these days. I mean, it's. Because you look at the map, it's one thing we can talk about when we come back. When you look at this map, I look at the map of the United States and the electoral map, and it's still like the it's still the Union versus the Confederacy. Mm. You know, I mean, it just looks that way. I mean, a lot of Western states were populated by folks, Confederate soldiers who fled the South and went west and became cowboys, and the Union guys became marshals, and they fought all the way through.
But Lenny's right in that it raises a much broader question about other changes that would have to be at least debated, and like the way we construct the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. And I think that is, if we're being equitable and fair, the process works there. But how can we throw out the baby, the Electoral College, with the bathwater, unless we're going to do major reforms on how we elect and choose leadership in this country? And I think that's an important conversation.
But it's also why it hasn't been done. It's because of how much work it will create.
But it's,
folks, we have to give a very quick break here, and we're going to come right back. And I know Amara, I thank him as always for being part of the show. I just love having him as a guest on the Mark Steiner Show. We're going to come back. Glenn Ford's going to be joining us from the Black Agenda report, and we'll have very different positions when Glenn joins as well, because he has a plague on both their houses, and we should be voting for third party. So we will come back to all that in a moment. We can take a very brief break and go back with the guests, so don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and it's a pleasure to have you all with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, the University of Maryland, go to www.umm.edu/heart. We are joined, Anthony McCarthy and I are joined, I should say.
Here, great to be here,
always
Monday.
Good. Monday. Anthony's with Monday. I like it. Monday's with Anthony.
Monday's with Anthony.
I need to get some sleep tonight.
that's not going to happen.
Dr. Kimberly Moffitt's in the studio. She's assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC. Lenny McAllister is with us, political commentator, author of Spoken Thoughts of an Amalgamated Advocate in Today's America. We are now also joined by Glenn Ford, executive editor for the Black Agenda Report. Glenn, welcome. Good to have you with us, too.
Thanks for the invitation.
It's always good to have you on the air with us. So we were concluding with this thing about the Electoral College. I don't know who was trying to break in at the very end, but about the usefulness.
I think Lenny was going to.
The usefulness or uselessness of the Electoral College. And then I want to turn to Glenn Ford. Were you trying to say something, Lenny, at the end as we were going to break?
No, I think we were talking about shifting the Senate and just basically how the Electoral College looks. I know that you were talking about how it looks more like, in some ways, the Confederacy
right,
the Union. And but part of that, if you look at it, part of it's how the political game has broken down and how the Democrats and Republicans have basically carved up the country and said, you can have this, you can have that. But as well, it goes back to how we have become extremely polarized as a nation. This is probably one of the most polarizing times in the history of the United States. So these states are going to look like this anyway. And yes, Mark, you brought up an excellent point. You have some battleground states, and some states are completely ignored. But again, if you say get rid of the Electoral College, I'll say, as a Republican, if you just give me the top, I'll say, 12 states and their MSAs, give me those, and you can have the rest of the country. That would be a great bet, because right now the Republicans are on the opposite end of that business deal. You look at the way votes go down in the top 10 to 15 cities in the United States, I would guarantee you that they probably lean 65-35 Democrat to Republican. My college buddy, Anthony Fox, mayor of Charlotte, was the last Democrat to take over a Republican mayoral seat in Charlotte, North Carolina, in I think it was 2005 or 2007. In fact, I believe it was 2009. Every city in the top 20 are all run by Democrats. If you get rid of that Electoral College and you just go by a popular vote, it's going to go all Democrat. And furthermore, I have to say, we're not a democracy. We're a Republican democracy. It's supposed to be a representative form of democracy, not a straight numbers vote.
Mm. All right. Glenn Ford, welcome. Good to have you with us. Do you have any thoughts on Electoral College? Should we jump into this campaign and what you think is missing from it?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment on the Electoral College.
Please do.
This Electoral College effectively disenfranchises about half of the black vote. About half of the black population, a little more than half, are in the states of the old Confederacy. And those states effectively, with some exceptions sometimes, vote Republican because the Republican Party is the white man's party, especially down south. And that negates the votes of the black folks who live there. So just from a racial representation point of view, the Electoral College is a huge burden to us that effectively negates half of our people. We should, and any progressive should, advocate a kind of proportional representation kind of voting wherever
right.
we can get it. And there are a couple of states, I believe Colorado's one, I'm not sure, but there are a couple of states that try to move towards that, at least allocating the electoral vote based upon congressional districts. That's not pure proportional representation, but it gets close. All racial minorities benefit from proportional representation. Just as importantly, political minorities, that is the progressive wing of this country, however big you might define that as being, but it certainly includes, in most circumstances, most black folks, would benefit from proportional representation. So that's what we ought to be talking about.
May I ask a question to that, please?
Sure. Then we're going to move to another topic, though, Lennon. But go ahead. Yeah.
No, I want to ask a question. The question would be, if you wanted to go to a straight popular vote and get rid of that, because, as you say, many minorities, including the African-American vote, get disenfranchised in the South due to the Republican South, would you be willing to get rid of the gerrymandered districts at the local and state levels from there on in that protects and gives African-Americans certain gerrymandered districts that slither in and move around like a snake because they're so gerrymandered? I mean, we can't have both sides of it. If you go popular vote, then you're going to lose some things at the local and state levels as well. And I think that as black people, we have to either say we want to play by all the rules, 100% above board, or we're going to understand that as we've given some, we're going to take some as well.
Now, first of all, proportional representation and popular vote, straight up majority wins are not the same thing. The reason for proportional representation, and this goes well beyond electoral colleges, is so that the various shades of opinion in a polity, whether it be a city, a county, a state, or a country, are represented rather than the effective majority taking all of the marbles when the game is over. Now you're talking about congressional districting. There has long been a struggle in which often Republicans and black politicians are on the same side in favor of creating safe black, especially congressional districts. I favor those. The Democrats are the party that favors watering down the black vote. They like congressional districts in which the black vote, which is reliably Democratic, can be spread out as much as possible over four or five districts if they could do it in order to lighten the load of whites that they have to convince in order to carry an election. They not only dilute the black vote, what is most important when we're talking about votes is what is behind the vote, the political opinion. And if black political opinion, which every study worth a damn has shown is miles apart from white political opinion on a whole range of issues, to the extent that black political opinion is diluted, then blacks are underrepresented, no matter how many Democrats are in office.
Let me kind of switch gears a little bit. There's a couple things I really do want to get into with you all while we're here, and I've neglected our callers. 410-319-8888. We'll come to your calls after this next round of questions to get you in on this, and we'll really let you wax forth on our state issues in the next hour as well. But there's a lot about this election that should leave voters questioning what they're voting for. I mean, when you see the debates, the questions that have been asked, when you see the stuff that's been written in many of the newspapers about the horse race and other things, there's very little substance in terms of what America's facing. And I think neither candidate, really, neither major candidate, has answered those questions, whether it has to do with climate change, poverty, really questioning about where the economy is going to go and how to get it there. And I think that that's a huge missing piece here, and you're seeing 10 million less people are due to vote in this election than voted in the last election. Now, the vast majority of those, or at least close to half or more of those, would have been Barack Obama's votes. Another, and if you look at the Suffolk University poll that came out a few months back that I harp on all the time, of the 90 million unlikely voters, both registered and unregistered, 43% said they would have voted for Obama, but they're not voting. 23% said they would think about a third party, and only 14% said Romney. And so I'm curious what that says about what this election really says to us. And I'll let you go. Kimberly, I'll let you start, and then I'll let Glenn please jump in, and then I'll go to Lenny.
Well, I think it speaks to our level of frustration with the system and where we are with our presidential elections. But I also think it speaks to another level of frustration of how politics are being played out before us, and that the shift is away from the actual issues, and we tend to focus more on the individuals and the personalities of those individuals. And as a result of that, it becomes a contest of who do we like versus who would we have our beer with, so to speak, more so than who is the individual that is going to carry the country to the next level and improve a lifestyle for all of us instead of just a minority population in the country.
Glenn?
Yeah, what we saw, and especially in the foreign policy debate, and what Black Agenda Report has been documenting for the last 4 years, is the basic agreement between these two parties, that is, the candidates at the top of these parties. There was virtually no disagreement whatsoever between Romney and Obama on any element of foreign policy. Romney was me too to every war that Obama was claiming credit for. All that Romney could add to the discussion was that he would somehow provide more of that intangible quality of leadership, and I guess that would be his chiseled white face. But essentially, they are in agreement. So I'm not trying to make a fine distinction in terms of word usage, but I think the problem is that we have two parties that are actually coming from basically the same place politically, domestically. Obama's job program is to provide tax incentives for big corporations to give them incentives not to ship the jobs overseas. Romney's jobs program is to get rid of all regulation and greatly reduce taxation on businesses and rich individuals in order to supposedly give them incentives to somehow create jobs. But there is no jobs program, no real jobs program proposed on either side. So that is an agreement from the tops of both of those parties that there shall not be a massive federal intervention or even a small mini intervention specifically to create jobs, because jobs are what is needed. We, that is Black America, have rendered ourselves for the second presidential election in a row absolutely irrelevant to the discussion, because we have not made one demand or one strong proposal or even one mild suggestion to the Democratic contender in the race. And I'm 63 years old today, and these these have been the first, thank you, these have been the first two presidential election cycles in my lifetime in which we have been absolutely ineffective, irrelevant, and had nothing to say.
Whew, okay. Lenny, you want to jump in there?
It sounds like you've been taking a little bit of that Democratic medicine for the last 40 years. There's a reason why Black Republicans sit there and say there's a better way of doing things. And that's not necessarily saying that the current construct of the GOP is the way of doing that, because between the voter suppression efforts and John Sununu statements and other things, there's obviously a lot of work to do in the Republican Party. But if African Americans are not willing to step up to the plate and hold the first African American American president accountable. And I've said it more than once. I've said it more than twice. There's two things that go on with President Obama. Number one, it's great to have the first African-American president. I'm still waiting for the first black president. And number two, is this the only black president, the only president, that the only time he says the word black is when he says the word tie after it and asks for $2,000 from everybody in the room. When this president can be held accountable, whether he wins re-election or as they go out the door with a lame duck session and Governor Romney comes in after tomorrow night, African Americans with the black agenda need to hold the presidency accountable. And I think that it's a microcosm of what people were feeling in politics. They're willing to vote for the popularity contest, but they don't know who to hold accountable, how to hold people accountable, and how to elevate the political realm. And I think that the disappointing thing about what you're seeing in American politics, and dare I say even state and local politics as well, is people vote for politicians. Nobody votes for statesmen and leaders anymore. And America needs statesmen and leaders a lot more than we need good politicians. And I think that, unfortunately, we're right back at voting in two politicians and hope that whoever gets the most votes will become the president versus voting a leader and a statesman that's going to turn things around, speak specifically to jobs, speak specifically to education, bring both sides together, and make some of these things irrelevant that we've been arguing about over the last 24 months, from the Tea Party element to the GOP primaries, all the way through to these debates and some of the circus-like environment that we've had around these debates and the general election.
So let me throw out another thing about this election that I'm finding more interesting to watch, because, as I said earlier, a lot of the major issues facing America, from climate change, which maybe is kind of poking its head under the table, under the tent just because of the disaster of Sandy. Otherwise, neither candidate would have raised the issue, and nobody in the establishment press will raise the issue. But the other issue that's always lurking here is called race. And when you look at who's voting for whom, what it says about America and where we are, if in fact this election, I mean, Democrats have historically not gotten the votes of white people in America. I think even less than Obama, the candidates before him got less white votes than Obama did. Obama got 40.
The last time that a Democrat got a majority of the white vote was 1964 with Lyndon Johnson.
Correct. You said it much more succinctly than I, Glenn. but it says a lot about where we are. If 60% of white Americans vote for the Republican Party, and a majority of communities of color, with the only kind of mostly white constituency voting in a majority for Obama being Jews, then this says a lot about where we are. So what about this? We're always afraid. People are afraid. Let's start, Glenn and Kimberly. They are afraid to kind of raise the issue, both in terms of how I think many people emotionally voted for Barack Obama because of his message of hope and because he was black. The idea of history of racism and slavery and oppression and discrimination, to have a black family in the White House meant something viscerally to many people, as it meant something viscerally to a lot of other people about not wanting to have this black face in the White House. Glenn?
Yes, and ironically, the ascension of a black person to the White House has resulted in a purge of racial language from the political conversation.
Right.
I don't believe that is progress. We need more. When we are in an actual objective crisis, we need more than symbolic progress. And how long does that work anyway? Is that symbolic progress good for 40 years or 50 years or 5 years? Or has it, in fact, already outlived its usefulness? And all that we're left is a language that does not even include the vocabulary to describe our situation.
Are you laughing, Lenny? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that goes back to leadership. We had a very great Chicago politician that came in the office, and I can tell you, after being in Chicago for 2 years, there's a difference between leadership and being a politician or being a politico. Now, the president had the opportunity, had the political capital to come in and be post-partisan and be post-racial. Remember, one of the first things he said, which was in February 2009, the first Black History Month with an African-American president in the White House, is when Eric Holder said that we were a nation of cowards for refusing to speak on issues of race. embraced. President Obama basically told him to shut up and go sit down someplace before you ruin this for me. And you haven't heard too much from Eric Holder since, and you haven't heard President Obama mention anything about race other than take off your house shoes and put on your marching boots and telling black fathers you need to raise your kids. Other than that, he didn't say anything about Darian Albert in 2009 until after Chicago lost the bid for the Olympics for 2016. He didn't say anything about Trayvon Martin until bloggers on both sides of the aisle, including myself, pushed him on radio, pushed him in print and everything else. He jumped to the defense of Skip Gates because that was his friend and that was a former Harvard guy. But other than that, this president has not spoken about the Chicago violence. And when he did bring up the Chicago violence, he had the audacity to say these kids were shooting each other with handguns. When's the last time he's heard anything in Chicago? I can tell you those kids shoot up AK-47s all about when I was living on the south side of Chicago. So this is a president that squandered a lot of political capital. And part of that goes back to Black America's fault because voting carte blanche for somebody that kind of looks that like them, that never really had their interest at heart, versus looking at policies and procedures and then making votes accordingly. And we've been doing that for 40, 50 years. So he's just the epitome of what Black America has been doing wrong politically since the Great Society.
You know, some history thinking, shaking things have happened under this president. Particularly in terms of the relationship between Wall Street, that is finance capital, and the U.S. government. Under Barack Obama, things have occurred that we could not have imagined would have occurred 4, 5, 6 years ago. The U.S. government, through the Federal Reserve and through the U.S. Treasury, has funneled $16 trillion to Wall Street on Obama's watch. You can't tell the difference between where Wall Street's accounts end and the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. Federal Reserve's accounts begin. They are so commingled. There is a window that all of the largest banks, not just in the United States, but in the world, can go up to. It's a figurative window, and get what is essentially free money, money at almost zero interest rates. And then these large institutions can buy U.S. Treasury bonds and get more a higher return on the interest rates from those Treasury bonds than they paid for the money that they borrowed from the federal government. This is an outright subsidy on a massive scale. $16 trillion is more than the gross domestic product of the United States. And yet that is what has occurred under this regime. So, it is a mixing of the Wall Street sector and the public sector that would have been unthinkable prior to the ascension of this president, and yet we don't talk about it as if that is a black issue.
Kimberly?
I think we are in a space where this has not been before us before, so that whoever is in office had to make certain decisions that may not have been reflective of what has been done in the past in this country. And then to go back to the point about race, I mean, I do find myself agreeing with both Glenn and Lenny on many points, but I also raise the questions of what else were we expecting of an individual that is responsible for all Americans in this country? What did we expect in terms of there being a separate black agenda that Obama was responsible for while he continued to run the country? Or were we looking for him to make sure everyone understood that he was black at every instance in which he was before the press? And I think that is when we get into debates in which we are placing something upon his body that not necessarily is responsible for that one individual to take on.
That is a cop-out.
Lenny, I promise our listeners I get at least one question here from our audience. Let me do that for you in the hour. Michelle, you're on the air. Hi, Michelle, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Lenny, I like your tenacity. I like the things that you're saying. I definitely love the young lady that is in that room with all of you. But let me tell you what I hear. We can never, ever decide on what is best for us as black people, as a group of black people. It's not Obama's responsibility. It's the people on the front line, the delegates, the senators, the mayors, the governors. Hold them accountable first. Hold them accountable first and then let them hold Obama accountable. What's happening on the city level, I'm saying here in Baltimore, is utterly ridiculous when it comes to politics. Politics and politicians. And I'm talking just the black ones. I ain't even going to the Republicans. I'm talking just about the Democrats. How the heck you going to get to Washington if you can't handle what's happening right here and make sure that it's happening for the people of color? I'm tired of politics in Baltimore. I ain't even got to Washington yet because I can't get over what's happening here locally. Help us. I hear a lot of brothers and sisters on this station right here who seem like they have some leadership. Lead this first. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for your comments. I think we're about wrapped up. Michelle might have had the last comment, at least for this hour. And I want to thank all of our guests. Glenn Ford, thank you so much for being with us. Executive Director of Black Agenda Report. I guess we'll see you tomorrow night at realnews.com. I will be co-hosting over there with Paul Jay, and we'll be talking about the election all night tomorrow night. You can join us there at realnews.com after 8 o'clock. Lenny McAllister, always great to have you on the air with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I always enjoy it.
I look forward to having you back. And Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, always good to have you. Thank you for coming to the studio.
Thank you. And I want to invite Lenny to come and hang out with me at UMBC so we can have a conversation. Now that you're in D.C., you must come and hang out with me.
I will take up your invitation. I will probably do it in 2 weeks when I wear my Steeler garb for the first Baltimore Ravens Steelers game.
Look out. Look out.
Oh, God.
Have mercy. I do like the Steelers. I'm one of the few people who likes I do like the Steelers. I'm sorry. I usually have that rapist crazy man as a quarterback. Other than that. I did like the Steelers before that, though. So, and Anthony McCarthy, we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
So don't go away, folks. We're going to switch to state politics and take a look at the referendums facing us and what we think and what you think at 410-319-8888. Stay with us.